Chapter 23. The Curious Incident of the Shoe in the Night Time. Day 8. I awake, groggy, with a mouth as dry as my assistant's cake. Footnote, not a euphemism. I curse myself for drinking fortified wine. Who fortifies wine? It's one of the few drinks that requires no fortification. It already comes fortified. My hand ducks inside the waistband of my trouser for its morning scratch. Scrit, 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 and then away. I enjoy the sensation enormously. The first backside scratch of the day is always a treat, although I really should get it looked at. And eyes closed, I mumble out loud, "Scratching is fantastic." Oh, I open one eye and see some teenagers looking at me. I'd forgotten I was outside. I raise a hand apologetically and look for Brian, as the teens wander off, clearly in a hurry to fail their GCSEs. I spy Brian on the grass a few yards away, curled up. I grunt, "Brian! Brian!" Nothing. "Brian! Brian! Brian!" Still nothing. "Brian! Brian! Brian!" Still nothing. "Brian! Brian! Brian!" Anyway, this carries on for a while, until I realise something. Brian isn't breathing. Like a cat on a hot tin bench, I leapt from my bench, bound over to him to try to spin him over, but his torso crumples and I realise that this isn't Brian at all. These are just his clothes. I sit there, utterly bamboozled. Where had he gone? And then another more profound thought. Was he ever even here? Perhaps Brian was merely an invention of my fortified, wine-addled mind. Perhaps in my drunkenness I'd been sitting here shooting the breeze with a pile of old, pissy clothes. Or maybe he was a road spirit. Some Native Americans believe weary travellers are visited by well-meaning spirits who provide guidance on the long, dark nights. I enjoy that thought and sit for a moment dwelling on it until I realise something. These aren't Brian's clothes. They're mine. I look round for the rest of the rucksack. It is gone. And I only bought it a week ago. I curse the gods until I realise something. I'm only wearing one boot. My sock quickly becomes sodden from the morning dew, and I hop around angrily until I realise something. The boot must have been stolen. I look heavenwards until I realise something. It must have been stolen by Brian. Yes, it seems Brian has made off with my bag, wallet, watch and snacks. It's a pity. I hadn't told him this, but such was our connection last night. I'd intended to gift Brian a few £1,000 and find him work in television. Don't believe me? Well, that's up to you, Brian. But if you were here now, you'd see me looking you in the eyes. And not blinking, which proves it's the truth. Obviously that offer is now rescinded, but I hope you read this and realise what your selfishness has cost you. £10,000 in cash and a creative director position at Pear Tree Productions, complete with generous salary package, car, private healthcare and share options. And, as I say, that is true. Sounds like you chose pretty unwisely, amigo. But hey, enjoy the rucksack, Nature Valley snack bars and walking boot. While a lot of people, certainly those in my pub quiz team, think that vagrants are evil, I have always defended our hard-of-housing friends, and I'm not about to change that stance now. I just think it's sad that someone like Brian has betrayed the cause of his more noble colleagues, setting back perceptions of vagrancy by several decades and scotching any attempts by yours truly to persuade Cromwell's bitches and others that tramps are decent guys who need to be given a chance. And, as I say, I think that's a shame. I mean, why had he only taken one boot, for crying out loud? Spite? Forgetfulness? Perhaps he was startled and fled. I sometimes bark half-formed words in my sleep, such as, "Haw!" or "Stubborn!" Maybe he just wasn't able to remove the second boot, or had forgotten how laces work. I imagine him peering at the miniature shoe ropes, his tongue lolling from his stupid mouth before shrugging and walking away. Yes, Brian is a prized dolt, all right. And just my luck, he's taken the boot from my injured foot, causing the gash to reopen and blood to leak into my dewy sock. Either way, I don all of my remaining clothes and begin to walk on, having fashioned a boot from plastic carrier bags lined with slices of bread that have been left in the park for the ducks. Such improvisation is nothing new to me. I once spent a weekend trapped in a warehouse and managed to survive by fashioning a gown and cowl from bubble wrap and packing tape. That gown and cowl saved my life and felt pretty sassy as well. I still wear it round the house on Saturdays when I'm listening to records or vacuum cleaning. As I stride along in boot, bag and bread, I call my assistant to sound off. I tell her the news and she gives one of her non-committal grunts, a noise she produces when she knows she has to make a sound to register she's heard me, but can't think of anything to say. I carry on. And he had the nerve to suggest I should be trying to resurrect that Harvey Kennedy deal. Huff, she proffers. I know, like I'm going to take the advice off any Tom, Dick and Harry. I mean, what am I going to do, turn up at the guy's house? She makes a less enthusiastic noise, which I know is because I said the word Dick. She's unable to differentiate between proper nouns and swear words, which is why she refers to the well-known British garden bird as a blue chest. Preposterous, I continue, turning up at the guy's house. Silence. Turning up at the guy's house? Ha ha! I chuckle. Silence. At the guy's house, I add. I walk on for a few seconds. Do you think I should turn up at the guy's house? This throws her. What about the walk? She asks. I sigh and explain to her very slowly, very simply in terms that hopefully she'll understand, that footsteps of father's walks don't have to follow a precise route. They just have to be an approximation of the original journey. A minor detour to the house of an influential television and literary agent is hardly going to trash the meaning behind the journey. More than that, I say, playing my trump card, I believe it's what my father would have wanted. The raised inflection at the end of my sentence only slightly subtracting from its persuasiveness. I ask again, does she think I should turn up at the guy's house? And after an interminable period of her muttering and trying not to be drawn, I decided that one of her grunts, yiff, sounds enough like a yes for us to have agreed on my heading to the house of Harvey Kennedy for a chat about this exciting potential TV project. It's a shame, I say, I don't have his address and have no means of getting it, knowing full well that the slighting of her abilities as an executive assistant is one of the best ways to motivate her. I move the conversation onto other matters that do concern her, filing, replacing squeaky office chair, sacking cleaner, and hang up. And sure enough, a few minutes later, she texts me, 302 Elm Drive, Pinner, Middlesex, asterisk X. I put the phone away, do a 180, point myself in the direction of Pinner, and walk, making surprisingly good time as my feet pound tarmac and white bread respectively. If you're not familiar with the geography of the southeast, imagine that London is a scowling face. I'm currently near the right jowl as we look at it. I guess Pinner would be up past the left eyebrow, which is to say it's not strictly on my way to Dungeness. It's more of a tight right angle or just over, and will require, what, 4 days of solid walking just to get there and back. But it'd be good to put the notion to rest once and for all, one way or the other. Good. Pinner nestles like a slumped dog between Ruislip, Northwood and Harrow. It takes its name from the River Pin, which wends its way through the village and whose banks are lined with anglers, or pinpricks, if, like me, you despise anglers. To get there will involve turning back and recrossing the Thames, which I'm happy to do. I set off with a spring in my step, yomping away at a considerable lick until... Gah! A pain sears through me like jam syringed into a doughnut, me being the doughnut. The foot wound has opened up again after snagging on a sharp stick. The thin plastic skin of my carrier bag shoe no match for its jaggedness, and as for bread, well, it's been beaten so thin by my body weight, it's as if the sole of my foot is clad in damp communion wafer. It too is torn by stick, and as for my skin, well, it too is torn by stick. I bleed. I don't have time for this, and so I push on, leaking gouts of blood every time I put weight on the foot. It doesn't hurt, it just feels horrid as my bag shoe gets spattered with blood like a consumptive's hanky. Eventually it stops, the worst of the blood soaked up by pounded bread, now the width of graphene. Footnote. Look it up, fascinating material. I get back onto the ferry. In next to no time I'll be back in Tilbury, so I use the journey to bandage my foot in the men's lavatory with the age-old method of wrapping toilet paper round and round and round and round my injured foot, until there are just 4 pieces of toilet paper left. If I've judged this right, that should be just enough to clean my backside after what I hope will be a straightforward ablution. And it is. The texture of stool exactly as firm and dry as I'd hoped. I could probably have done it in 3. With the toilet paper cylinder empty, I leave the toilet and nod at the man waiting for the cubicle, debating whether to inform him of the lack of toilet tissue. I dislike his facial expression immensely, so I decide not to bother, and after he's entered and shut the door, I smile as I hear the clack-clank of a hastily unbuckled belt. He'll find out the hard way. Once in Tilbury, I disembark and plunge Londonwards, the outline of its grey buildings muscling into the sky like a rude person's bag on an empty train seat, which you see a lot of in London. Anyway, the day consists of me walking again and trying to convince my assistant to wire some money to me, which I would collect at a branch of Western Union. She hangs up on me several times, convinced it's a scam, since the only time she previously wired money to Western Union was when she sunk £2,000 of her mother's inheritance into a friendship with a foreign correspondent by the name of Godfrey Tweed, who was eager to leave Lagos and come home to Norfolk to take lunch with her. The fact that his surname contained three E's and he spelt Norfolk, Norfroke, hadn't rung any alarm bells with her. But I knew that Muggins here would suffer the fallout when she did realise she'd been conned, so I ended up emailing Godfrey, threatening to call the police, and then with him off the scene, setting up a fake email account under his name and entering into a 6-month email correspondence with my own assistant. A staggeringly tedious exchange during which I/Godfrey let her down gently, promising to remember her always, and paid her back £2,000 from my own money, purely to spare me the grief of having a grumpy assistant moping about the place, believe me. I have to say the Godfrey emails were a wonderfully sustained and at times touching collection of dramatic writing that I unwisely printed out and kept, and that my assistant stumbled on one day after I asked her to dig out the manual for a juicer. Talk about hopping mad! Footnote. Kept the 2K though, didn't she? Anyway, it's now left her paranoid of Nigerian scammers and the money transfer industry in general. In the end, she drives into London so we can rendezvous at Stratford, where she winds down the window and holds a hold-all of cash at me without stopping, for reasons best known to herself. Whether you call it money, cash, or in the case of Dave Clifton, spondoolies, it feels good to have it plumping in my pocket once again. With it I'm able to buy a fresh set of training shoes from Westfield Shopping Centre. What a shopping centre! What a shopping centre! And find accommodation in the Premier Inn there. I watch the King's Speech on television and descend slowly into the dream state, i.e. go to sleep. Footnote. I used to go out with the girl who stammered, and this film reminded me of her, made me think I should have handled our relationship differently. Like the speech therapist in the film, my approach was very much tough love. Talk properly, I'd shout, or I'd demonstrate how straightforward speaking was for me. It was designed to inspire her, but her mum had a word with my mum, and I wasn't allowed to see her after that.